Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. Now, I want to return to an issue that we were alerted to by one of our callers yesterday. Alva called in to tell us that the free IVF that we heard about in the budget, that election budget that we had last October, where women who had secondary infertility, this is where you already have a child, but you then discover that you can't have any further children. We were told in that budget that the free IVF scheme would be extended to include people, couples in that situation. Our caller yesterday, Elva, told us that unfortunately she had been to her doctor in the last couple of weeks and had been told that actually the scheme has not been put in place yet for couples in her situation. So I want to bring in Rachel now. Rachel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm delighted to talk to you again. Of course, Elva actually was in the Mail on the Irish Daily Mail today talking about this as well. And Rachel, tell me your own situation.
So I spoke with yourself, Katie, back in 2020 when myself and my husband started out on our IVF journey. So obviously when we started out, there was no even talk of an IVF scheme, a government-funded IVF scheme. And that was the reason that I had initially got in contact with you, and I had told you that I had reached out to every sitting TD in the country at the time. So that brings me straight into where I am now. So I done a round of IVF. I was lucky to have my child on the first go, and that's quite unheard of, but incredibly lucky. I delivered my son in 2021. And then myself and my husband decided that we would like to extend our family in 2022, and we done a frozen embryo transfer, and that failed. And as I was explaining to your colleague earlier on, I decided, look, maybe now is not the right time. I'll just take some time for myself, get a little bit fitter, get a little bit healthier. And so we revisited the IVF situation in late 2023, start meeting with our clinic. And in 2024, I had a second egg collection. That was a good enough cycle, to be honest with you. We done 4 transfers. I got pregnant once and sadly miscarried twins last summer.
Oh, that must have been heartbreaking, Rachel.
Yeah, heartbreaking is putting it mildly. When you get pregnant and you miscarry, especially when you're on your IVF journey, you feel like the IVF journey is over and you kind of go, whew, that's it. That's the end of the road now with the IVF. You know, great. Well, for me, it certainly was, because I had just wanted to add one more child to our family. But
and
sadly, that ended.
The joy of hearing twins and then.
Yeah. Complete joy. Panic as well, because I was like, oh my God, I'll have to change the car, or, you know, like, you have a million and one things. And then sadly, like I said, it ended in miscarriage at just a little bit over 8 weeks. And then we decided to do another transfer after that. And sadly, that failed. I done another collection then in January of this year. It turned out to be our worst cycle yet. And I've actually just paid on Monday for our 4th collection. So I'll be going under another egg collection in about 4 weeks. So this will be my 8th round of IVF.
This must have cost you a fortune, Rachel, by now.
A fortune, yes. We are at just over €50,000 in trying to have our second child, and that's including all of our collections, our transfers, and some additional testing along the way. With no help from the government. So of course, in October, when the budget was announced, I was cautiously optimistic. I was kind of excited, because while we have a living child, our living child is from an IVF cycle, which that was never taken into consideration with the initial criteria set out by the government. So it was like, if you have a living child with your partner, you can't avail of it. But really, it should be a little bit more flexible than that. Like, you know, regardless of how you've got your living child, whether it's naturally or through IVF, I mean, you should fall into the criteria. And we definitely felt, because our child is via IVF, we should fall in for the free round.
Can I ask you, Rachel, if you don't mind me asking, did you always know you were going to have difficulty having children, or how did you realise that it was going to be IVF or nothing for you?
Yeah, so in some cases, and I want to say this quite loosely, myself and my husband have male factor infertility. So it's a male issue for us. And my husband actually had a very severe case of the mumps when he was 19, which has caused us to have to go down this road. Now, let me be clear. We didn't ever expect to have to do IVF, because post his mumps diagnosis, and when it was all cleared up, we actually approached his GP and said, hey, look, can you just check us, or check him, to be sure that there will be no repercussions later down the line? And his GP laughed at us and was like, you're 19, you want to have kids? And we were like, yeah, not right now, but like, we want to protect our future.
Well, you were together when you were that age?
Yeah, we are, we're 18 years together.
Oh my God. So, absolute childhood sweethearts.
Yeah, so a lifetime together. But
so you've been talking about kids since you were teenagers, basically.
Well, I suppose yes and no is the answer. I suppose at 19, you never know if you're going to end up together forever. But it was always, we knew we were quite compatible. So let's just be sure that we can protect the future. And I'm a great advocate of, you know, even if he wasn't with me, why shouldn't he protect himself? You know, so that would have been the outlook. So I would have definitely encouraged it to make sure that he was okay. But the doctor had done a set of like standard full blood count, and just was like, yeah, everything's okay, when really he should have been sent for a sperm sample.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's where we are. So, yeah, that brought us right up to October, thinking that we might be included in this new budget announcement. And sadly, since that budget announcement, I have spent €16,000 on IVF.
And did you, because obviously it was announced in the budget, and you know, you expect it to maybe take a little while, but you don't expect it to take until, where are we now, 9 months later or 6 months, 8 months later. Before you started paying for or putting more money into your own IVF procedures, did you kind of stop and think, hang on, will I hang on here? If I hang on for a month or two, we might find out we qualify for this free cycle.
No, is the answer. Like I said, cautiously optimistic. I was like, let's just keep, we'll proceed with what we're doing with the plan. And if this comes to fruition, great, let's jump on it then. Unlike your caller yesterday, I didn't start gathering my paperwork and getting the ball rolling from that perspective, because I suppose I didn't want to waste time, if that makes sense. I didn't, this particular topic for us is very at the forefront. We're giving it our all, both physically, mentally, emotionally and financially. We're giving it everything we have, trying to achieve this second child.
That 16,000 that you've paid since this announcement was made, is that... Did you have that resting in an account, Rachel, or was that a big stretch for you?
No, it's a big stretch. I mean, you put your life on hold. Can I go on the holiday? Jesus, the sofa is filthy. I need a new sofa. Okay, we can't actually afford to get the sofa. We can wait. We can change the furniture. Or we can do something else when I'm pregnant. When I get over that 12-week mark, we'll do this, this, and this. So no, like we've had to borrow money to get that, you know, to do this. I'm not ready to give up. The only thing that will give up on us is our finances, physically and mentally and emotionally. It's the hardest thing I've done, but I'm well able to do it. But there has to be additional support by the government. There has to be, you know, when the last time I spoke to you, Katie, there was only two countries in Europe. There was Lithuania and Ireland that didn't have state-funded fertility treatment. And yet the criteria is almost way off the mark. You know, it excludes an awful lot of people. And you know, it's not fit for purpose. And to continue kicking the can down the road is not a solution for the women of our country. It's not an option. It's not. Don't ask us to go out and vote for you guys if you're not to go, if you're not going to come through on your word. It's not fair.
Okay, just I'll just remind people, I did read this yesterday, but I'll just read it again. This is what the HSE said to us when we asked them about it yesterday. They said that the HSE is currently engaging with the Department of Health in relation to the ongoing management of the publicly funded assisted human reproduction treatment scheme. They said this includes consideration of issues associated with the expansion of the access criteria and the services provided. And it says that this process may take some time. And they say they will provide further information when the work is complete. And then we also since then have gotten a statement from the Department of Health. And they are telling us that Minister Carl McNeill, that's the Minister for Health, hopes to be in a position in the coming weeks to make an announcement in respect of this specific criterion in order to allow for those with one child already but who are having difficulties in having a second child, these are people like yourself, Rachel, and like Elva yesterday, to access publicly funded assisted human reproduction treatment as long as, of course, they meet all the other existing criteria. So she's saying there basically that hopes to be in a position in the coming weeks. So that's the latest on that.
Is hope, I mean, all the women, including myself and anybody that is in the IVF world, hope is all we hold on to. And yet the government are asking us to put additional hope in them. All we hope for is that second child or that first child in some people's cases. I mean, it's completely unfair. And like I said, to keep kicking that can down the road is putting people's dreams at jeopardy. And what I mean by that is that this is a very time sensitive topic, and time sensitive, I mean biological clock, meaning that since October, we've had a countless women in this country that have been 39 and in their birthday, they've turned 40. We all know at 40 that your chances of having a live birth significantly drop. I mean, that's not fair on the women of this country to put their right to a child or their want to a child at jeopardy because it's they hope to do something. It's not good enough. It's completely unfair. And there's no unity in, you know, or coming together, you know, for positive outcomes for women in this country.
I know. And I said this yesterday to Elva as well. I think just the fact that it resonances with what happened with the free HRT promise as well, mm-hmm. In the same budget, it was thrown out there and it was a big thing and a lot of women really, really latched onto it for good reason because mm-hmm. there's so many women who have to fork out for HRT every month now. Yeah. And now we heard last week that an agreement has now been reached with the pharmacists union and that it will be put in place. But like, The idea that these statements are made in a budget context, in an election context, because of course that was the election budget, and without the groundwork having been done, that's the issue. Especially as you say, when you're talking about something as sensitive, time sensitive as this, and when people's, you know, the most fundamental thing that is there for many women is on the line.
Yeah, and you know, it is. I mean, it does kind of turn to something else sensitive as well, because you have some people that are making these decisions or creating these rules that are kind, that might turn around and say, sure, are you not happy with the child you have? or, you know, are you not happy with, you're a mother now, can you not just be happy? And the answer to that is, well, don't ask me something as sensitive as that. And to me, I'm like, don't ask me a stupid question, because on the flip side, I'm like, well, why do you want to change the car? Why do you want to further your career? Don't ask me why I want to further my family. It shouldn't be a question. And we all put our hopes and dreams and give it 110% to mentally and physically preparing ourselves to go through. And I'm not sure people realize the journey from, you know, stimulating your ovaries to collection to transfer and then to your 2-week wait to your pregnancy test. I'm not sure people realize the effort that the female puts into it. And now you're asking us to wait longer. It's not okay.
And remind us again, how many times have you put yourself through this now, Rachel?
This is my 8th round. I'm going into my 8th round.
That is a lot of stress on your body physically, like just putting yourself, like you get hopped up on those hormones, and that drives your emotions crazy as well, obviously. So it's a big ask you're asking of yourself to put yourself through this. But is there any point you think, this is it, I can't do another?
For me, no. For my husband, yes. After my most recent egg collection in January, I was incredibly sick after it, and he just looked at me and he was like, I can't put you through that again. I can't ask you to continue doing that to your body. But for me, I will put myself through it, because the ultimate goal, or the end goal, or the North Star for me is that second child. And I'm not sure if that comes back. I'm an only child myself, so to have that second child for me is a big thing. But yes, it's incredibly physically draining, mentally draining, emotionally draining. And believe it or not, from my very first round of IVF to when I delivered my son, I took over 600 injections. I put that into context.
Say that again. 600 injections.
600.
And you give them to yourself, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a qualified nurse now. well, loosely. I can't tell you how many I've taken with my 7 following rounds. I couldn't tell you how many injections I've taken, and the amount of sharp bins that I have filled. And yeah, I've no idea.
What do you find the worst part? Because I know, as you say, that the journey is you have to do all those daily injections and to take your body has to respond to all those hormones.
Yeah.
And then you have to go through the harvesting of the eggs. Then you have to hear how many of them survive, mm-hmm. or are good out of that. Then how many are fertilized. Yeah. Then how many are available the day of implantation, and then you have the 2 weeks. Like all of those elements of that journey, must be so stressful. Like for you, what do you find the part that you dread the most?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I'm incredibly lucky. I don't really get any adverse side effects to the hormones. I'm usually quite a well balanced person, so I don't get. A lot of women have a lot of ups and downs with the hormones. I'm very, very lucky, like I said. The bit that I find for me, I can control the injections. I do my bit. I go in, go under sedation, have my eggs collected. Brilliant. The bit that I find incredibly difficult is the next bit, which I say is the numbers game. It's how many eggs are collected, how many eggs are mature, how many fertilized, how many made it to day 3. So basically day 3 is how many cells do your eggs and the sperm met together, how many cells do they have? Then we get to day 5. Do we have any that have expanded correctly? And will a fresh transfer go ahead? And how many embryos do we have out of it? So it becomes a numbers game. So you could start off with a lot. I'll tell you, my most recent collection was 16 eggs, 14 mature, and 12 did not fertilize. I had 2 that fertilized and 1 that made it to embryo. So that will tell you the large drop-off. And for me, I find that very hard.
Because it's a roller coaster ride. So you're like, great, 16 eggs. And then you get the news of,
Yeah, that's the bit. And let me be quite clear. A lot of women struggle with the 2 week wait. So after the transfer to your pregnancy test, standard is usually 2 weeks before you go in for your HCG blood test. For me, I don't find that part too difficult. I like to keep myself busy, whether it's down with the local sports team or reading a book or whatever, even just with work, throwing yourself into work. A lot of women do find that part extremely difficult, and I can see why, because you're hyper alert to whatever's going on in your body. If you've a pain in your big toe, you're going, oh, is that implantation? You know, you're hyper alert to what's going on in your body. It could be anything. And you're jotting it down and you're writing notes and you're trying to keep a diary to see does anything change from cycle to cycle. But for me, the most difficult part is that from collection day to day five. I find that the most difficult.
Do you have support groups? Is there WhatsApp groups? Is there, like, do you keep each other going? Other people in the same situation?
I am a private enough person, which is contrary to me speaking on the radio. my family know, but my colleagues wouldn't know. And I have a very, very tight-knit group of friends. I have like five girls that I would trust with my life, and they have been through, you know, the ups and downs of it all. But in relation to other girls in the support, no, I wouldn't share my story. However, I would be a support for other girls going through it, because I'm involved with a ladies sports team, and they would come to me and they'd say, hey, I'm actually struggling or whatever. And I suppose they probably think to themselves, how does she know so much about that? And maybe they have an inkling into how I would know so much, but I would be the support, or I tend to take on maybe a little bit more than I should, but I wouldn't do it if I wasn't able for it. And I'm, like I said, I'm quite an optimistic person. I trust in the process, trust my clinics, my doctors, my consultants, whatever the case may be. I trust them. I tend to not overanalyze, or I don't turn to Dr. Google like a lot of people would, because I'm not a trained doctor and I don't know what information to take out as true or false. But from a support network perspective, I would be the support for other people.
Well, I'm sure our conversation today will have been supportive, given some support and comfort to other people as well, Rachel. Listen, the very best of luck. We will keep an eye on this, because it's really extraordinary that it's still not in place, and we still don't have a date for when it should have been in place months ago. But Rachel, thank you for that, for sharing your story today.
No, I really appreciate the time, and hopefully we can generate some waves, and maybe the right people will start listening, and we can keep advocating for each other and making sure that women in this country are listened to, and we can get what's right.
Well said, Rachel. Thanks, Emil.
Talk to Jo on 0818 715 815.
Too often we hear from people who have been thrust into the justice system through no fault of their own, and that is when they realise that the justice system comes up short. The person we're going to talk to now, Georgina, is someone who became immersed in the justice system for almost a decade. Georgina, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're finally out the other end of it now, Georgina, but you got in touch with us because you want to talk about what all of your experience was like and how you think it could be changed to help make the experience, I won't say good for victims, but I suppose less horrific. And just to give listeners a bit of a background to this, your three children, they're now adults, were abused by your former partner, Brendan Cornelly, who earlier this year received a sentence which will see him serve 17 and a half years in prison. So maybe we could start by talking about the offender in this case, Brendan Cornelly. He received mitigation in his sentence.
Correct.
And I know this is something you have taken particular issue with, because that mitigation, some of it was down to the fact that he entered what is called in legal circles an early guilty plea.
That's correct, Katie. And the issue that I have with it is that what is the whole understanding around mitigating, or sorry, not mitigating, but the early guilty plea? What exactly does that mean? You would imagine it would mean that somebody who has committed crimes and who's been charged with them would admit guilt early on because it's an early guilty plea. But in actual fact, on the eve of all three cases prior just to trial, Brendan Carnally, only after 6 and 7 years of waiting for a guilty plea, then he put it in. There was nothing early about that.
Yeah, and just to explain to people, these three cases were heard separately, two of your sons and your daughter. And in each of the three cases, the guilty plea came on the day before the trial.
Yes. So when somebody is charged with offences against the state, they are given opportunity to defend themselves, as it is their right, their legal right, but also if they have opportunity to put in a guilty plea. An early guilty plea is one of the mitigating factors where Brendan Carnally was given a reduced sentence. That early guilty plea was considered early because it was just before the trial. But in our case, it took 6 years and 7 years to get to that point, in which case he only then put in a guilty plea before trial.
And you can understand why this has been put into the system, because obviously it's to try and save victims from having to go through their evidence, trying to save the state, I suppose, from the expense of court cases. So it is there to encourage perpetrators to put in those guilty pleas. But that you get mitigation when it arrives so late is the issue you have, Georgina.
Absolutely. If somebody is charged with crimes of that nature, if their concern was to save the victim of further trauma, it would not be drawn out to 6 and 7 years at a time. I am looking for a policy change whereby the guilty plea must be put in a year from the time charges have been given to the perpetrator. So a year, that saves a lot of trauma in waiting for a trial, in waiting for, because you're already in the height of emotion at that point. You don't come out of it. But for something to be drawn out, it's very tiring, it's exhausting, it affects your mental health, that goes into your physical well-being, your work life, your family life. It just spills out into all quarters, and it's destructive, and all because somebody who is guilty doesn't admit guilt, only to leave it to be too long in the day, where all damage, further extra damage, is sustained to the victim.
And I know that, as you say, because there was such a time lag between the abuse being reported and the case coming to court eventually, that had a really, really detrimental effect on your son that has special needs, Georgina.
One of my children was diagnosed with autism, mild general learning difficulty, also as a young child. And Brendan Carnally had access to my son. And he brutalised him. I'm not going into the details of it because this isn't what this is about. This is about trying to highlight the deficiencies and the deficiencies in the justice system. So he brutalised my son and he with special needs, and he became hospitalised, and he was medically diagnosed with catatonia. For people who don't understand what catatonia is, it's known as the ultimate regression. The ultimate regression is where you stay in a frozen state for hours. You can't eat, you can't dress, you can't go to the bathroom. It is ultimately, seriously, the worst thing for a young man who just 2 years ago did Leave and Cert Applied, and now he can't cross the road.
Yeah, that's the point, that this is a child who, you know, had his challenges, but was well enough to attend school and get succeed with a merit award in the Leaving Cert Applied.
Yeah, he did everything. He was very independent, but now he's lost all form of independence.
And you believe it was the stress, in particular in that last couple of years in the run-up to this trial, that
it's not just
impacted
my opinion.
Him.
It is the psychologist who has medically diagnosed my son with catatonia in her report for the court's purpose, has recognised that my son was diagnosed with catatonia as a result of the long wait, the 7 years he waited for the conclusion of his trial. Yeah.
And I just put this to you, and I know that Ms. Justice Biggs, who was the trial judge in the case, she said, and she acknowledged that you were an extraordinary mother, Georgina, and I hope that gave you, you know, some bit of comfort. But she said it was her job as sentencing judge to take a number of factors into account, and that she had to carefully consider these factors in sentencing
Brendan Cronally. I understand that having been in the justice system for so long, the confinements that people work within, she's also restrained. She may be the boss, but she has to work within a restrained environment as well. So unfortunately, she found herself giving a reduced sentence because of the laws around the Irish system. I'm sure under the circumstances, because it was given the potential for the most serious of serious crimes in Irish law, which is 15 years to life. But unfortunately, because of the Irish system, the way the law is constructed, Miss Caroline Biggs confined herself in the sentence that she was able to give, which led to him to this day not serving one day in jail for what he did to my son.
There is an issue. I know you also took issue of the fact that Brendan Cornally expressed remorse through his barrister, and the impact that would have had on his sentence.
Well, it benefited him to say it, but it was of no benefit to me and my son. But I have a real problem with the fact that for someone to plead I'm sorry, and not even to say it themselves, but to have their barrister speak on their behalf, it was part of the Irish law again that gives him a mitigating sentence. Again, this is another area where he gets reduction in his time in jail because his barrister said, I'm sorry. That is not worth anything to me or my son, who have been left with no help, no support, whilst Brendan Cornally gets a reduced sentence because his barrister said, I'm sorry.
I know you say you understand the principle of rehabilitation in the criminal justice system.
I do. And everyone is entitled to rehabilitation, and everyone is entitled to be reintroduced into society. I'm all for second chances. However, when it comes to certain crimes of child rape and child sexual abuse, I believe that there should be a lengthier time. I believe, because of the legal system, the way it's constructed, that Caroline Biggs was not given the opportunity to sentence this individual, Brendan Cornally, to a lengthier time in jail. It wasn't her fault. It was hardly even her decision. She is bound by rules herself. And this is just a fact of life. And he should be in jail for longer. He was given 17 and a half years, but he will only serve 12 and a half because of good behaviour in jail, which means the 5.5 years that Judge Caroline Biggs gave to Brendan Cornally for the rape and sexual abuse on my son, he will not serve one day. And that is not justice. And that is because of the justice system that governs our island of Ireland is just not fit for purpose, and it needs to be changed.
Yes, but and again, I'll just repeat what Justice Biggs said. She said that she had carefully considered her sentence. She couldn't reconsider it. But I know you've said you appreciate she's just working within the rules that are set down for her.
Even Judge Biggs is bound by rules, and more so because she is of the highest level of law in our island. She herself has to be seen to be holding it up even to a much more astringent manner than anyone else. So I don't have any adverse feeling towards Caroline Biggs, Judge Caroline Biggs. I do understand the restraints that she's working within. And that is why, Katie, I am on the radio station with you today, because something has to change. When somebody commits a crime of that depravity, there should be lengthier sentences. And the judges need to be given the opportunity and the right and the will to exercise that.
You have also decided, Georgina, to take a civil case now, but you are also here to tell us how expensive it is if you want to go down that road.
Well, I got myself, I hired a solicitor, and I have been informed that it's going to cost me €20,000 to actually hire a barrister, because I know Brendan Carnally has full ownership. He's the sole ownership of a house in Tullamore, which I won't give out the address to. He also has money in his bank account. My son has been reduced to a 2 or 3 year old. He cannot make any decisions for himself. He cannot cook for himself. He can't even, you know, have the intelligence to go and wash himself.
Yeah,
so I need help for rehabilitation, and that's going to come at a cost. Brendan Carnally has property, and he is trying to sell that property, and I have to get an injunction so he cannot sell that property, and that is going to come at the cost of €20,000. I do not have that. And very few people, I would put it out there, would have that kind of money that they could just put their hand on and just, there's the money for it. I don't have that. I'm a middle class working single mum, and I need to be able to provide for my children. But because I don't have the money, it means my silence is there again, and my son suffers onwards into his life because I can't provide financially. Brendan Carnally has equity, and I want to take that equity, not for me, for my son, because my son needs help. My son needs help, and people need to be paid for that help. That's why I'm here.
It's not just, though, for the financial,
I want to hurt him, Katie, absolutely, because he's not going to spend one day in jail because of mitigating circumstances. He gets out early. The 5.5 years that Brendan Carnally was sentenced for, it has now been removed because of good behaviour and mitigating circumstances. So with that in mind, he won't spend a day in jail for what he'd done to my son. So I have to go and get justice another way. And that is why I'm on the show. I want him to feel what it is like. I mean, he'll feel what it's like to lose a house. I've lost a son. Even in that, there's no justice. But he will feel what it's like to lose something, because I want to take it from him. I want to sell it, and I want to get help from my son, because we have no help in this country for my son that I can afford at present.
Now, Georgina, how are you? How do you deal with all of this now, looking back? I know you've spoken about feeling guilty for bringing him into their lives.
Well, this is it. A mother is a mother, and the whole world can say to you, you didn't know. Of course I didn't know, but they're still my children. And had I been not so trusting, had I asked more questions, had I been a little bit more reserved in my resolve, none of this would have happened, because I wouldn't have got involved. Unfortunately, I became very involved. And now this has happened and I will carry that to my grave. There is no two ways. And every day I'm triggered with new memories and it's upsetting. I wake up thinking about it, I go to bed thinking about it. I'm in the shop, somebody asks me who I am and I say I'm okay. And they say, you're not okay, Georgine, I can see it. And of course, I am like in a flood of tears in the middle of a shop in front of strangers. And this is every single day, every single day. And it's for my children as well. They may take breaks, but because I'm fighting for justice for my son in particular, I don't take that break. And it's constant and it's wearing and it's hard. Yeah.
And I will just remind you again and remind listeners what the judge said. And she heard all the elements of this case, that you were an extraordinary mother, Georgina. And you have to hang on to that in the middle of all of this.
It's nice for somebody to say it. But I mean, at the end of the day, proof is in the taste of the pudding. And my children were damaged. And because I brought a man into their lives. And that, regardless, that is fact. That is black and white. I like to deal with currency of truth, and unfortunately that is it, and it'll stay with me. And I think I've earned the right to keep that, even if it is a bit of punishment for myself. I think I deserve the right because I have hurt my children and they will never recover.
Georgina, I wish you the very, very best of luck, and I want to thank you for sharing what is obviously a very, very difficult story. But the very best.
Katie, thank you. Thank you for having me. I really feel people need to be more careful. Don't allow people take your trust. Question everything. It's not a bad thing to question. And people need to earn it before you give it. And that's where I went wrong. And there's a lot of vulnerable people out there. And people need to mind themselves. Really do, because when it happens, it can't be undone and you're left and your poor babies are left with the trauma. Don't be afraid to ask questions and to say no and back away for a time being until you're sure.
Georgina, thank you so much.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I want to go back to an issue that caused quite a stir yesterday. This is when housing official from Mayo County Council, Tom Gilligan, called for a community-led boycott against owners of holiday homes, which he said were, you know, it was like basically a morally wrong to leave houses empty when we were in the throes of a housing crisis. Larry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You have a second home, Larry.
I do indeed, Katie. I have a second home down in Kilmore Quay. Well, near Kilmore Quay. I say Kilmore Quay. I was a mile or so out of Kilmore Quay as the crow flies. And I've had it there for about 25 years. Myself and my late wife, we bought a site down there in the 90s. Had it for a few years before we could afford to build on it. And we built on it, and it's been our home from home for all of those years, and thoroughly enjoy going down there.
Now, I see reading The Independent again this morning. That's where the story broke yesterday.
Yes.
People very, very upset by this. A lot of people, you know, are very connected with the communities that they have their holiday homes with. They spend a lot of time there and are very, very upset that, you know, they might, you know, that they might not be made feel welcome.
Yes. Well, I saw Tom Gilligan, like, I believe he's an accountant by profession. And in fairness to him, I think what was written was some internal email, not necessarily meant for public consumption, really more of a discussion. And I can understand that we have a housing crisis in Ireland at the moment. A lot of pressures and a lot of young people, renters, etc. And I'm very cognizant of that, having three adult children myself, all looking to get on the housing market at some stage. My idea, anyway, Katie.
Yeah, you have an idea. Yeah, let's not talk about the problem. Let's talk about solutions.
Let's talk about the solution. Yeah. Yeah, well, my idea is basically a simple enough one. It's really possibly to eliminate CGT on the sale of secondhand homes. for a fixed period of time.
Sorry, on second-hand homes? On second homes, you mean?
I beg your pardon. On second homes, or right. holiday homes, or second apartments, or second properties that people might have for one reason or another. In my case, I have a second home, which is a holiday home. I use it, and my family use it, and friends use it. I don't rent it out. I don't Airbnb it. Like, as I say, it's a home from home, and that's what it is. But just a thought occurred to me. I mean, some people buy these, purchase these homes, and they're really a method of providing a pension for themselves into the future. And my idea, such as it is perhaps if we could look at eliminating CGT.
And just to explain, people, CGT is capital gains tax, of course.
Yes.
And that's is it 33% is the current rate for CGT?
I believe that's what it is at the moment. It's around that. So it's a sizable chunk of money that a person would be expected to pay revenue in the event of the sale of a second property.
Yeah, but just to be clear about this, it is, as the name is on the tin, as I say, capital gains tax. So it would be 33% yes. of the profit
gain.
On the gain you have made. So the
Absolutely.
On the profit
on the
you're
gain.
Making on that.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so... You know, you by definition, you will have had to have made a profit for you to have to pay that tax.
Yeah, indeed.
I don't know, Larry. I think a lot of people might take issue. If people can afford a second home, they might think, well, they really can afford to pay the tax on the profit they have made in it. Do you not think?
Well, that's in certain cases there, that's true, absolutely. But you know, the idea here is possibly to release. I'm not talking about indefinitely into the future, taking CGT away on second homes or second properties. I'm talking about for a period of time, maybe for 3 years. So a person, in my circumstance, if I was to sell my house, I wouldn't be charged CGT. I'm not thinking of selling it, by the way. But if I was, I wouldn't be charged CGT. And also, I was just thinking about that since I spoke with your researcher, Tara, this morning. There would have to be some sort of condition attached to it whereby I couldn't go straight away and reinvest this money in another property and, you know, gain from this. So the idea is to unlock second properties that are owned by people, you know, and they're all over the place. And maybe some people have second properties in towns and they just can't afford to do whatever necessary repairs that might be needed on them. And this is just a way of possibly releasing those properties out into the market. For instance, I think Tom Gilligan was saying there are 6,000 holiday homes in Mayo alone. Now, he wasn't including just second properties that are rented out long term. He was just talking about holiday homes. So there, in addition to those, there would be other types of properties that are owned by people that are not the primary residence. They could add on to that 6,000, probably a few thousand more, and that's just one county. So
yeah, so you're saying the possibilities there as a once-off opportunity, kind of like a tax amnesty, basically, for in a scheme.
Similar to that. But that, you know,
to free up these houses,
Yes, it would be. First of all, you'd have to have a time limit, so maybe a 3-year window, and it would encourage kind of immediate action from owners. It would prompt them, you know, if they've been sitting on an asset such as a second home, to finally sell it. You know, it would probably moderate prices as well, because you'd have a lot of properties coming on the market, and it would have to be a temporary incentive. You couldn't have it going on into the future. I imagine as well it would probably be both left and right of politics would probably be happy with that.
Well, I was going to say you probably find people on left and right would both be unhappy with that, Larry, for various reasons.
Unhappy? Would you?
I would just say that there may be. I would say this. There would be a considerable number of people that would say exactly as I said there earlier, that if you can afford that second house, you should pay the taxes on it.
Absolutely.
On the profits on it.
Yeah, well, ordinarily you would be paying purple, but you know there are a lot of people who are sitting on second homes, and who are probably not using them or not, and they're just not getting rid of them because they're of that chunk of CGT that is would be due to be paid. Anyway, either way, Katie, that CGT is not being released in any case. It's not being released, so it's not the government aren't getting this CGT anyway at the moment.
So your argument is this could be a bump for the free up a huge number of houses that were not.
Maybe a
significant cut in the CGT rather than something as drastic as completely doing away with it for.
But 33% is huge. It's a huge tax. Absolutely. If people can afford a second home, well, yeah, but then they can afford to take a hit on tax like that. Absolutely. I understand that. But we have a crisis here at the moment. And I think this is, and by really incentivizing people to really consider offloading second homes, like a period of time, an amnesty period, as you could describe it as an amnesty, but an amnesty period of perhaps 2 or 3 years would incentivize people to seriously look at selling up.
Okay. Would you sell your house in Kilmore Quay if you got?
Well, you see, I used to be the president. Now I'm on a committee because I have 3 adult children who love going down there. So I'm outvoted on that front at the moment.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Larry, we'll put that out there. It is a suggestion. It is
food for thought, Katie. Well,
food for thought, exactly. Let's see what everyone else thinks about that one. Larry, thanks for that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, spare a thought, people. Spare a thought for all the football fans out there who are about to be plunged into cold turkey withdrawal when the season comes to its end this weekend. Andy, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you, Kate?
I'm good. Andy, what preparations have you made for the withdrawal season?
It's worse than that because I'm an Everton supporter, and the reason why I'm an Everton supporter, my dad told me when I was 6 or 7 that his first cousin, Tommy Ring, played for Everton. Now, last Sunday was the final game in Goodison Park, home of Everton, and I've been there for 133 years. So I've been going there for 50 years, Katie. So it's going to be sad. I couldn't get a ticket for the last game. I was there twice this season, though, to say goodbye to the grand old lady, as it's affectionately known. But I got a lot of friends in Everton because of my connection. And I remember in 1996 going up to. I heard that the Everton team were staying at Jury's. They won the cup in '95, and I was at the final. So I just took a chance of going into Jury's, and I met this guy called. Jimmy Gabriel, who played alongside my cousin. So I just said, hi, Jimmy. And like that, he just said, come over here, Andy, join the group. So I was in the middle of all the Everton guys sitting beside Joe Royal, the Everton manager. And a guy called Mark Ward became probably my best friend, to be honest with you. He had a pint that looked a bit off. I said, Mark, give me that pint. He said, where are you going with that? So I went up to the bar, and he followed me up, and I changed it. And we had a great laugh. And ever since then, I've stayed in his house and he stayed in my apartment in Aberdeeks. But before I say anything more, can I just mention 4 people who are fanatics? And, by the way, Everton fans are different than every other because I don't know any Everton fan who's not totally a fanatic.
Well, you'd want to be a fanatic to stay supporting Everton, to be fair, Andy. When was the last time you won anything?
I was at the Cup Final 30 years ago, 1995. And I didn't believe when I was at that match that I would have to wait. And probably another 10, 40 years before we win. Mind you, we have a new manager now, David Mays, and he's absolutely magnificent. But can I mention, Peter Rogers brought me to my first game, I believe, when I was 16. Mm-hmm. And he's a fanatic. Michelle Rogers, Tony Kavanagh, and Antonio Mazzotelli. He owns his family owned the Papanoni's, a fantastic, authentic Italian restaurant in Aberdeeks. There's a plug now. I'm expecting a free lunch for that.
That was a shameless one there, a shameless one, Andy. Can you tell me, because for me, I always say to the football supporter in my life, 'tis the hope that kills you.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, Everton, unlike any other. Everton have the most Irish players ever to play in the Premier League. And, of course, Scousers have 75% Irish heritage. So, you know, very close to Ireland, and Mick Meagan and some fantastic players played with, Irish players played with Everton. I've got, because of my cousin, I've got blue blood running through my veins, Katie.
I know, I'm really was taken with it. Our colleague here, Brian Lally, was in Goodison Park for that last match last weekend. It was just incredible, the emotion that he caught on tape from people.
Well, I watched it on TV, and I must say, Mark Ward looked absolutely fantastic, my mate.
Okay, do you know what? This is your life, Andy, but do we have Mark on the other line?
Yes, Mark's here, listening from Liverpool.
Good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
Good afternoon, Katie. Good afternoon, Andy. How are you?
So you were there. You were there at the match, along with 69 other former players.
Yeah, Katie. It was a great game to go to, because obviously it was the last one at Goodison, and all the great players that had played for Everton over the years, different eras, different generations from the, you know, the 50s, the 60s, right the way up when I played in the 90s. And it was very emotional, as you could gather. We all met in the Titanic Hotel early on in the morning at 8 o'clock for a bit of a champagne breakfast, and then was ferried up to the stadium, and we went with all the supporters up to a part of the main stand. I think it was 70 ex-players, and it was just a great occasion. It's very sad, but you know, time's time, and you've got to move on, because Goodison, really, for all the history and everything else, it's fallen down. So it's moving to a new stadium for next season now.
And Mark, tell me, your family were Everton supporters. Was that the draw for you at the beginning? Yeah.
Yes, my dad was you're born an Evertonian. We were the first club in the city. If you know your history, that's our song. And you look back, Everton were the first club, and you know, a proper Scouser is always an Evertonian. That might upset a few Liverpoolians, but that's the truth.
I was going to say, that's going to upset a few Liverpool fans out there. Were you scouted very young for them? Like, at what stage did you start playing?
My dad was an Evertonian, and, you know, as a young kid, I was showing promise, and Liverpool were after me, Everton, Man United, and I was only tiny, I'm still only tiny, and, you know, it was difficult for me, but I was always fearless in the tackle and things like that, and I ended up signing for Everton when I was 12, and then becoming an apprentice, and it was great to see the lads who were a lot older than me on Sunday, who I used to clean their boots and that, you know, so a lot of respect in that aspect, because they don't do it these days. But when I was an apprentice, when I left school, we were taught how to, you know, look after the players, and that was part and parcel of the job. And I always thought that was good grounding for the likes of myself and other players who went on to, you know, have a great career, really. But, you know, I'll never forget Sunday. It was, you know, not just winning the game, but, you know, meeting everybody from Joe Royal, all the legends. It was Peter Reid, big Duncan Ferguson was there. It was a fantastic day.
Going back to your own career, though, Mark, they actually let you go from Everton when you were still a teenager.
I was 18, and I was devastated. I remember getting the bus home and meeting my dad at home, and cried like a baby. You know, devastated I was. And, you know, the words from Gordon Lee was, I'd never be big enough, quick enough, or strong enough. So, you know, I had to go backwards to go forwards, and then I went and played non-league, and then Joe Royal signed me for Oldham, the great Everton legend. He was the manager at Oldham for £9,500, and sold me 2 years later for £250,000, and then I just progressed to Man City under Howard Kendall, and then back to Everton 10 years later for £1 million. So, you know, it's not about proving Everton wrong. It was, you know, having to prove to myself that I was good enough.
That must have been a great day, though, the signing, the million pound signing.
Oh, it was I was in Cork on a pre-season with Peter Reid, who just took over from Howard Kendall, and we were doing a pre-season, and he gave us a day off, and I went over the bridge, and I went for me Guinness, and I was writing me bet out. We had a full day off, and it was great, because the training was quite difficult at that time, and Sam Ellis said to me, Mark, you've got to go back to the hotel, the gaffer, meaning Peter Reid, has got some news for you. And I just said, Sam, go away, politely. And I said, I've just got me Guinness. You just want me to walk back to the hotel? You know what I mean? It was a mile away. And he picked me Guinness up and drunk it in one and turned his glass upside down on the bar. So I knew he meant business. So I trunched my way back to the hotel, got to the manager's room, Peter's room, knocked on the door, and he said, get on the next flight to Liverpool, you're signing for Everton. And it was just incredible. I nearly broke down because I'd, you know, I'd worked 10 years to the day to get back to the club that I loved, and we couldn't get a flight till the next day. So we had a great night in Cork, loads of Guinness, and then went and signed for Everton the next day. And I scored on my own debut against the champions, Arsenal. We beat them 3-1. So it was a great, great first game for me.
A sweet, sweet return.
Yeah, it was very much so.
And that was the start of a phenomenal career, Mark, for you.
Yeah, just progressed really then because, you know, to go back to the club who you loved and idolised, I was just like, I was, you know, we didn't have a very good side in my second season, and with Howard Kendall, I'd signed for him at Man City. I was going to go and play in Spain, but I signed for Howard Kendall, who took over at Man City, and I was only there 18 months, and then when he came in for me at Everton, that was just unbelievable for me, and I had three or four good seasons there before moving on to Birmingham City, and I had a great career considering I was told I would never be big enough and you know to make it as a footballer, but it just kept it.
Looking back, being told that, was that the spur that drove you on through all those years?
Well, to be honest, Kate, at 18, I was still, you know, I was always going to, my dad wasn't the biggest man in the world, so I knew I wasn't going to be, you know, that big. But I worked at my physicality, so what happened with me, I went in the gym, got really strong, and with my strength and the power, I got the pace then. And in 2 years, I got really quicker, and that was the difference of me being a player and not being a player. Because when you've got pace and you use it to your advantage, you've always got something go for your opposition. So that was the main thing, and I never gave up. That was the thing for me. I never gave up, and I had the hunger. So yeah. I'm glad I did because I achieved, you know, quite a lot.
You did, and you have, as you say, fans like Andy that'll remember the great days you gave them. But if we roll right on then, Mark, because your story took a dark turn when your career ended.
Yeah, exactly, Katie. I don't mind speaking about it. I've wrote a book about it, but obviously I went to prison and I did something wrong and I got caught up in with the wrong people. And, you know, I eventually done 4 years in prison. So, you know, it's not something I'm proud of. And it's my biggest regret in life because not only let myself down, but my family as well and everyone close to me. And I always remember the great manager, Howard Kendall and Duncan Ferguson, coming to visit me. In the Rochdale prison, and you know, I was devastated because he never come to visit me in Liverpool, and I didn't really think about him coming to visit me because you always think about letting people down, especially people have helped you through, you know, through your career. And Howard had signed me twice for £1 million. So, but I always remember the day that he come into the prison. I was in the visits room and with big Duncan Ferguson, he'd done a bit of jail himself up in Scotland, and Howard's words will never leave me. He said, I'm here for you now. I'm here for you when you get out. He said, so, he said, you know, the football family will be there for you. Yeah. So, and as it was when I come out, all the clubs that I played for, West Ham, Man City, Birmingham and Everton, they've always been there for me. So I'm a lucky guy, really.
And Mark, because I was listening to Niall Quinn talking about this actually at the weekend, how difficult it was when he finished up in Sutherland quite suddenly himself as well, when he had the falling out with the manager there. Just how psychologically different it is if you've been playing at that level to suddenly have nothing.
Yeah. Mark used to share a room with Niall Quinn when we played with Man City.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I was played with Niall at Man City. I would sign him from Arsenal, and what a character and what a great man he was. Very generous guy.
Yeah.
Great player. And but you're right, Katie. You know, football is, if you don't plan for life after football and it soon creeps up on you, you know, and I mean, in like when I played, it was decent money, but it wasn't the money that I'm now. But it's no excuses. And I think you lose if you're not prepared to plan and do something, you know, with your money and things like that. That's how I got into trouble, I'll be honest. You know what I mean? So there's a massive void when football goes from you.
Can I just put in here, Matt? Yeah, yeah. Putting her. Andy, I want to suggest, could you mind, Katie? Myself and Mark are organising an evening with Duncan Ferguson, Kevin Sheedy, Liam Brady. It'll be hosted by Mark in a hotel in Dublin, just before the, hopefully before the new season starts.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you any more plugs now, Andy, that you want to get in?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Hang on. Will you both hang?
For a job as a salesman. If sales,
you can tell he's a salesman, can't you?
Yeah, can for sure. Yeah. Will you both hang on for me, please? I'm really enjoying the conversation, but I have one more break to get to.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Okay, I just thought you'd all enjoy that. Janice, you called
hi,
in. You wanted to say hi to Mark and Andy.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, just that. I just give the thumbs up for Everton. I think it was sad on Sunday just to see Goodison closing for the last time. You know. And I've an Everton supporter. My son is at Everton, and for his sins, I suppose. But he's been very loyal to them over the years. And I always said to him, like, it's very easy to be a Man United supporter, Kieran. It's very hard to be Everton. But he stuck by them, and he still goes over to the matches. And
do you know what? You know, it's character forming, Janice.
It's what?
It's character forming.
It is absolutely character forming. Now I've twins. One is United, and one is Spurs. So that was their night last night now, you know.
All right,
so it used to make for great football on a Saturday afternoon in my house with all the different teams, you know.
I was saying, yeah, and of course Spurs were always wanting to win the Europa Cup. That was always the plan, wasn't it?
It was great.
Listen, I am actually out of time and I'm just looking at the clock. Mark, it was lovely talking to you. Andy, thanks for
brilliant.
for getting in touch.
Thanks very much.
I was at the
Cup Winners' Cup in 85 when Everton won their only European. I was in Wembley in 95 when they won the FA Cup, and my son is 30 now and he hasn't seen anything, only the Goodison Park. Katie, you're an absolute star. You're really good at this. I hope you're hanging up from the show, are you?
Take care, Andy. Good luck. That's it. That's all we have time for. Sean Marin was our broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound. And the programme today was produced by Emily Phelan. Stand by now for a
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain embedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.
Thanks very much, Katie. 3 o'clock on RTÉ Radio 1. Time to go to our newsroom now and to Shane McGowan.